For, the whole thing is a hoax, a psychological warfare trick.
You mean a trick of ours?
Said Purdy. Sure, to make the Soviets think we could reach them with a guided missile. But I don't think that's the answer, I just listed it as a possibility. DuBarry considered this thoughtfully. In the first place, you'd have to bring thousands of people into the scheme, so the disks would be reported often enough to get publicity. You'd have to have some kind of device, maybe something launched from high-flying bombers, to give the rumors substance. They'd certainly do a better job than this, to put it oven and it wouldn't explain the worldwide sightings. Also, Captain Mantle wouldn't kill himself just to carry out an official hoax.
John's right, said Purdy. Anyway, it's too ponderous. It would leak like a sieve, and the dumbest Soviet agent would see through it.
He looked back at my list. Cross off number one. There's too much competent testimony, beside the obvious fact that something's being covered up. That leaves Russian or American missiles, I said, as Steele first suggested. But there are some points that just won't fit the missile theory.
You've left out one answer, said Purdy.
What's that?
Interplanetary.
You're kidding, I said.
I didn't say I believed it, said Purdy. I just say it's possible.
DuBarry was watching me.
I know how you feel. That's how it hit me when Ken first said it.
I've heard it before, I said. But I never took it seriously.
Maybe this will interest you, Purdy said. He gave me a note from Sam Bowl, just talked with D, the Notran. D is a prominent aeronautical engineer, the designer of a world-famous plane. He believes the disks may be interplanetary and that the Air Force knows it, or at least suspects it. I'm enclosing sketches showing how he thinks the disks operate.
He's not the first one who told us that, said Purdy.
We've heard the same thing from other engineers. Over a dozen airline pilots think they're coming from out in space. And there's a rocket expert at Wright Field who's warned Project Saucer that the things are interplanetary. That's why I'm not writing it off.
Have you read the Project Saucer Ideas on Space Travel?
DuBarry asked me. I told him my copy hadn't reached me.
He read me some marked paragraphs in his copy of the preliminary report. There has been speculation that the aerial phenomena might actually be some form of penetration from another planet. The existence of intelligent life on Mars is not impossible but is completely unproven. The possibility of intelligent life on the planet Venus is not considered completely unreasonable by astronomers. Scientists concede that living organisms might develop in chemical environments which are strange to us. In the next 50 years we will almost certainly start exploring space. The chance of space travelers existing at planets attached to neighboring stars is very much greater than the chance of space traveling Martians. The one can be viewed as almost a certainty.
DuBarry handed me the report.
Here, I practically know it by heart. Take it with you. You can send it back later.
I know the space travel idea sounds silly at first, said Purdy, but it's the only answer that explains all the sightings, especially those in the last century.
He asked DuBarry to give me their file of historic reports.
While John was getting it, Purdy went on. Be careful about this man Steele. After what he said about moral responsibility, I'm sure he's planted.
I thought back to Steele's warning. I told Purdy, if he had the space thing in mind, maybe he's right. It could set off a panic that would make that Orson Welles thing look like a picnic.
Certainly it could, Purdy said. We'd have to handle it carefully, if it turned out to be the truth. But I think the Air Force is making a mistake, if that's what they're hiding. It could break the wrong way and be serious.
John DuBarry came back with a file of old reports.
It might interest you to know, he said, that the Air Force checked all these old sightings too.
The idea was still a difficult one for me to believe.
Those space travel suggestions might be a trick, I said.
The Air Force may be hinting at that to hide the guided missile secret.
Yes, but later on they deny the space thing, said Purdy. It looks as if they're trying to put people on guard and then play it down, so they won't get scared.
As I put the historic reports file in my briefcase, Purdy handed me a letter from an investigator named Hilton,
who had been working in the southwest. I skimmed over his report. Hilton had heard of some unusual night sightings in New Mexico. The story had been hushed up, but he had learned some details from a pilot at Albuquerque. One of these mysterious flying lights had been seen at Las Vegas, on December 8, 1948, just 1 month before Mantle was killed in Kentucky. It was too dark to make out the shape behind the light, but all witnesses had agreed on its performance. The thing had climbed at tremendous speed, its upward motion shown by a bright green light. Though the green glow was much brighter than a plane's running light, all plane schedules were carefully checked. I think they were trying to pin it on a jet fighter, the Albuquerque pilot told Hilton. But there weren't any jets near there. Anyway, the thing climbed too fast. It must have been making close to 900 miles an hour. The Air Force had also checked balloon release times, apparently just for the record, since no balloon could even approach the saucer's terrific ascent. Again, they drew a blank. From the way this was hushed up, Hilton commented, they seem to be worried about this group of sightings. I've heard to reports that the FBI is tied into the deal somehow, but that's as far as I can get. See if you can get any lead on that, Purdy told me. That FBI business puzzles me. Where would they come in? I said I would try to find out. But it was almost 4 months before we learned the answer. The FBI men had been witnesses. This was later admitted in an obscure cross-reference in the final Project Saucer report. But all official answers to the strange green light sightings had been carefully omitted. The cases concerned were 223, 224, 225, 226, 227, 230, and 231, which will be discussed later. When you go back to Washington, said Purdy, see what reaction you get to the interplanetary idea. I had a pretty good idea what the reaction would be, but I nodded. Okay, I'll go flag a spaceship and be on my way. Okay, gag it up, said Purdy. But don't sell it short. If by any chance it's true, it'll be the biggest story since the birth of Christ. Chapter 7. It was dark when the airliner limousine reached LaGuardia Field. I had intended taking an earlier plane. But DuBarry persuaded me to stay over for dinner. We dropped into the Algonquin, next door to True's office building. Halfway through dinner, I asked John what he thought of the space travel answer. Oh, it's possible, he said cautiously. The time and space angles make it hard to take, but if we're planning to explore space within 50 years, there's no reason some other planet people couldn't do it. Of course, if they've been observing us for over a century, as those old sightings seem to indicate, they must be far ahead of us, at least in technical progress. Later on, he said thoughtfully, even though it's possible, I hate to think it's the answer. Just imagine the impact on the world. We'd have to reorient our whole lives, and things are complicated enough already. Standing at the gate, waiting for my plane to be called, I thought over that angle. Assuming that space travel was the solution, which I still couldn't believe, what would be the effect on the world? It was a hard thing to picture. So much depended on the visitors from space. What would their purpose be? Would they be peaceful or hostile? Why had they been observing the Earth so intensively in the past few years? I could think of 100 questions. What would the space people be like? Would they be similar to men and women on Earth, or some fearsome Buck Rogerish creatures who would terrify the average American, including myself? It was obvious they would be far superior to us in many ways. But their civilization might be entirely different. Evolution might have developed their minds, and possibly their bodies, along lines we couldn't even grasp. Perhaps we couldn't even communicate with them. What would be the net effect of making contact with beings from a distant planet? Would Earthlings be terrified, or, if it seemed a peaceful exploration, would we be intrigued by the thought of a great adventure? It would depend entirely on the space visitors' motives, and how the world was prepared for such a revelation. The more I thought about it, the more fantastic the thing seemed. And yet it hadn't been too long since airplane flight was considered an idiot's dream. This scene here at LaGuardia would have seemed pure fantasy in 1900, the huge constellations and DC-6s, the double-decked Stratocruisers, sweeping in from all over the country, the big ships at Pan American, taking off for points all over the globe. We'd come a long way in the 46 years since the Wright brothers' first flight. But space travel. The gateman checked my ticket, and I went out to the Washington plane. It was a luxury ship, a 52-passenger, four-engine DC-6, scheduled to be in the capital 1 hour after takeoff. By morning this plane, the Aztec, would be in Mexico City. The couple going up the gangway ahead of me were in their late 60s. 50 years ago, what would they have said if someone had predicted this flight? The answer to that was easy. At that time, high school songbooks featured a well-known piece entitled Darius Green and His Flying Machine. Darius, it seems, was a simple-minded lad who actually thought he could fly. 50 years. That was the time the Air Force had estimated it would take us to start exploring space. Would Americans come to accept space travel as matter-of-factly, as the people now boarding this plane? The youngsters would, probably. The older ones, as a rule, would be a little more cautious. In the oval lounge at the rear of the plane, I took out the file of old sighting reports. Glancing through it, I saw excerpts from 19th-century astronomical and scientific journals and extracts from official gazettes. Most of the early sightings had been in Great Britain and on the continent, with a few reports scattered around the world. The American reports did not begin until the latter part of the century. The DC-6 rolled out and took off. For a few minutes I watched the lights of Manhattan and Greater New York twinkling below. The Empire State Building Tower was above us, as the plane banked over the East River. We climbed quickly, and the familiar outline of Manhattan took shape like a map pinpointed with millions of lights. Any large city seen from the air at night has a certain magic, New York most of all. Looking down, I thought, what would a spaceman think, seeing this brilliantly lighted city, the towering skyscrapers? Would other planets have such cities, or would it be something new and puzzling to a visitor from space? Turning back to the old reports, I skipped through until I found the American sightings. One of the first was an incident at Bonham, Texas, in the summer of 1873. It was broad daylight when a strange, fast-moving object appeared in the sky, southwest of the town. For a moment, the people of Bonham stared at the thing, not believing their eyes. The only flying device then known was the drifting balloon. But this thing was tremendous, and speeding so fast its outlines were almost a blur. Terrified farmers dived under their wagons. Townspeople fled indoors. Only a few hardy souls remained in the streets. The mysterious object circled Bonham twice, then raced off to the east and vanished. Descriptions of the strange machine varied from round or oval to cigar-shaped. The details of the Bonham sighting were later confirmed for me by Frank Edwards, Mutual Network newscaster, who investigated this case. 24 hours after the Bonham incident, a device of the same description appeared at Fort Scott, Kansas. Panic-stricken soldiers fled the parade ground as the thing flashed overhead. In a few seconds it disappeared, circling toward the north. Until now, I had supposed that the term saucer was original with Kenneth Arnold. Actually, the first to compare a flying object with a saucer was John Martin, a farmer who lived near Denison, Texas. The Denison Daily News of January 25, 1878, gives the following account, from Mr. John Martin, a farmer who lives some 6 miles south of this city. We learn the following strange story. Tuesday morning while out hunting, attention was directed to a dark object high up in the southern sky. The peculiar shape and velocity with which the object seemed to approach riveted his attention and he strained his eyes to discover its character. When first noticed, it appeared to be about the size of an orange, which continued to grow in size. After gazing at it for some time, Mr. Martin became blind from long looking and left off viewing it for a time in order to rest his eyes. On resuming his view, the object was almost overhead and had increased considerably in size, and appeared to be going through space at wonderful speed. When directly over him, it was about the size of a large saucer and was evidently at great height. Mr. Martin thought it resembled, as well as he could judge, a balloon. It went as rapidly as it had come and was soon lost to sight in the heavenly skies. Mr. Martin is a gentleman of undoubted veracity, and this strange occurrence, if it was not a balloon, deserves the attention of our scientists. In the file, I saw a memo Du Barry had written. I would take the very early reports with caution. For instance, the one on August 9, 1762, which describes an odd, spindle-shaped body traveling at high speed toward the sun. I recall that Charles Fort accepted this, along with other early sightings, as evidence of spaceships. But this particular thing might have been a meteor. Meteors as such were almost unknown then. The later reports are more convincing, and it is also easier to check the sources, especially those from 1870 on. From 1762 to 1870, the reports were meager. Some described mysterious lights in the sky, a few mentioned round objects seen in daylight. Even though they were not so fully documented as later ones, one point struck me. In those days, there was no telegraph, telephone, or radio to spread news rapidly and start a flood of rumors. A sighting in Scotland could not be the cause of a similar one 2 days later in the south of France. Beginning in 1870, there was a series of reports that went on to the turn of the century. In the London Times, September 26, 1870, there was a description of a queer object that was seen crossing the moon. It was reported as elliptical, with some kind of tail, and it took almost 30 seconds to complete its passage of the moon. Then in 1871, a large, round body was sighted above Marseille, France. This was on August 1. It moved slowly across the sky, apparently at great height, and was visible about 15 minutes. On March 22, 1880, several brilliantly luminous objects were reported seen at Kattenau, Germany, sighted just before sunrise. They were described as rising from the horizon and moving from east to west. The account was published in the British Nature magazine, volume 22, page 64. The next report in the file mentioned briefly a strange round object seen in the skies over Bermuda. The source for this account was the Bermuda Royal Gazette. This was in 1885. That same year, an astronomer and other witnesses reported a gigantic aerial object at Adrianople, Turkey. On November 1, the weird apparition was seen moving across the sky. Observers described it as round and 4 to 5 times the size of the moon. This estimate is similar to the Denison, Texas, comparison with an orange. The object would actually be huge to be seen at any great height. But unless the true height were known, any estimate of size would be guesswork. On March 19, 1887, two strange objects fell into the sea near a Dutch barkentine. As described by the skipper, Captain C. D. Sweet, one of the objects was dark, the other brightly luminous. The glowing object fell with a loud roaring sound. The shipmaster was positive it was not a meteor. In New Zealand, a year later, an oval-shaped disc was reported speeding high overhead. This was on May 4, 1888. About 2 years after this, several large aerial bodies were sighted hovering over the Dutch East Indies. Most accounts describe them as roughly triangular, about 100 feet on the base and 200 feet on the sides. But some observers thought they might be longer and narrower, with a rounded base. This would make them agree with more recent stories of cone-shaped objects with rounded tops seen in American skies. On August 26, 1894, a British admiral reported sighting a large disc with a projection like a tail. And a year after this, both England and Scotland buzzed with stories of triangular-shaped objects like those seen in the Dutch East Indies. Although many officials scoffed at the stories, more than one astronomer stuck to his belief that the mysterious things might be coming from outer space. Since planes and dirigibles were then unknown, there was no one on Earth who could have been responsible for them. In 1897, sightings in the United States began to be more frequent. One of the strangest reports describes an incident that began on April 9. Flying at a great height, A huge cigar-shaped device was seen in the Midwest. Short wings projected from the sides of the object, according to reports of astronomers who watched it through telescopes. For almost a week, the aerial visitor was sighted around the Midwest, as far south as St. Louis and as far west as Colorado. Several times, red, green, and white lights were seen to flash in the sky. Some witnesses thought the crew of this strange craft might be trying to signal the Earth. On April 15, the thing, whatever it was, disappeared from the Midwest. But on April 19, the same object, or else a similar one, appeared over West Virginia. Early that morning, the town of Sisterville was awakened by blasts of the sawmill whistle. Those who went outside their homes saw a strange sight. From a torpedo-shaped object overhead, dazzling searchlights were pointing downward, sweeping the countryside. The thing appeared to be about 200 feet long, some 30 feet in diameter, with stubby wings and red and green lights along the sides. For almost 10 minutes, the aerial visitor circled the town, then it swung eastward and vanished. The next report was published in the U.S. Weather Bureau's Monthly Weather Review. On page 115 in the March 1904 issue, there is an account of an odd sighting at sea. On February 24, 1904, a mysterious light had been seen above the Atlantic by crew members of the USS Supply. It was moving swiftly, and evidently at high altitude. The report was attested by Lieutenant Frank H. Schofield, USN, on July 2, 1907. A mysterious explosion occurred in the heavens near Burlington, Vermont. Some witnesses described a strange, torpedo-shaped device circling above. Shortly after it was seen, a round, luminous object flashed down from the sky, then exploded. Weather Review, 1907, page 310. Another cigar-shaped craft was reported at a low altitude over Bridgewater, Massachusetts, in 1908. Like the one at Sisterville, it carried searchlights, which swept back and forth across the countryside. After a few moments, the visitor rose in a steep climb, and the searchlights blinked out. There was no report for 1909 in America, though an odd aerial object was sighted near the Galapagos Islands. But in 1910, one January morning, a large silvery cigar-shaped device startled Chattanooga. After about 5 minutes, the thing sped away, appearing over Huntsville, Alabama, shortly afterward. It made a second appearance over Chattanooga the next day, then headed east and was never seen again. In Popular Astronomy, January 27, 1912, a Dr. F. B. Harris described an intensely black object that he saw crossing the moon. As nearly as he could tell, it was gigantic in size, though again there was no way to be sure of distance from him or the moon. With careful understatement, Dr. Harris said, "I think a very interesting and curious phenomenon happened that night. A strange shadow was noted on the clouds at Fort Worth, Texas, on April 8, 1913. It appeared to be caused by some large body hovering motionless above the clouds. As the cloud layer moved, the shadow remained in the same position. Then it changed size, diminishing, and quickly disappeared, as if it had risen vertically." A report on this was given in the Weather Bureau Review of that year, number 4599. By 1919, dirigibles were of course well known to most of the world. When a dirigible-shaped object appeared over Huntington, West Virginia, in July of that year, there was no great alarm. It was believed to be an American blimp, though the darkness, it was 11 at night, prevented observers from being sure. But a later checkup proved it was not an American ship, nor was it from any country possessing such craft. For some time after this, there were few authentic reports. Then in 1934, Nicholas Rerig, head of the American Rerig expedition into Tibet, had a remarkable experience that bears on the saucer riddle. On pages 361 and 362 of his book called I Himalaya, Rerig describes the incident. The expedition party was in the wilds of Tibet one morning when a porter noticed the peculiar actions of a buzzard overhead. He called Rerig's attention to it, then they all saw something high in the sky, moving at great speed from north to south. Watching it through binoculars, Rerik saw it was oval-shaped, obviously of huge size, and reflecting the sun's rays like brightly polished metal. While he trailed it with his glasses, the object suddenly changed direction, from south to southwest. It was gone in a few moments. This was the last sighting listed before World War II. When I had finished, I stared out the plane window, curiously disturbed. Like most people, I had grown up believing the Earth was the center of everything, life, intelligence, and religion. Now, for the first time in my life, that belief was shaken. It was a curious thing. I could accept the idea that we would eventually explore space, land on the moon, and go on to distant planets. I had read of the plans, and I knew our engineers and scientists would somehow find a way. It did not disturb my belief in our superiority. But faced with this evidence of a superior race in the universe, my mind rebelled. For years, I had been accustomed to thinking in comic strip terms of any possible spaceman Buck Rogers stuff, with weird-looking spaceships and green-faced Martians. But now, if these sightings were true, the shoe was on the other foot. We would be faced with a race of beings 100 years ahead of our civilization, perhaps thousands. In their eyes, we might look like primitives. My conjectures before the takeoff had just been idle thinking. I had not really believed this could be the answer. But now the question came back sharply. How would we react to a sudden appearance of spaceships, bringing that higher race to the Earth? If we were fully prepared, educated to this tremendous adventure, it might come off without trouble. Unprepared, we would thrown into panic. The lights of Philadelphia showed up ahead, and a thought struck me. What would Philadelphians of 1776 have thought to see this DC-6 flying across their city at 300 miles an hour? What would the sentries at Valley Forge have done, a year later, if this lighted airliner had streaked over their heads? Madness. Stampede. Those were the plain answers. But there was a difference now. We had had modern miracles, radio, television, supersonic planes and the promise of still more miracles. We could be educated, or at least partly prepared, to accept space visitors. In 50 years we had learned to fly. In 50 years more, we would be exploring space. Why should we believe such creative intelligence was limited to the Earth? It would be incredible if the Earth, out of all the millions of planets, proved the only inhabited spot in the whole universe. But, instinctively, I still fought against believing that the flying saucers were spaceships. Eventually, we would make contact with races on other planets. They undoubtedly would someday visit the Earth. But if it could be off? A problem for later generations to handle. If the disks proved American-guided missiles, it would be an easier answer. Looking through the Project Saucer report Dubarry had loaned me, I read the space travel items, hoping to find some hint that this was a smokescreen. On page 18, in a discussion on Mars, I found this comment: reports of strange objects seen in the skies have been handed down through the generations. However, scientists believe that if Martians were now visiting Earth without establishing contact, it could be assumed that they have just recently succeeded in space travel, and that their civilization would be practically abreast of ours. This because they find it hard to believe that any technically established race would come here, flaunt its ability in mysterious ways over the years, but each time simply go away without ever establishing contact. There could be several answers to that. The Martians might not be able to live in our atmosphere, except in their sealed spaceships. They, or some other planet race, could have observed us periodically to check on our slow progress, until we began to approach their level of civilization, or in some way caused them concern. They would probably see no reason for trying to make contact. But somehow I found a vague comfort in the argument, full of holes though it was. Searching further, I found other space travel comments. On one page, the Air Force admitted it was almost a certainty that space travelers would be operating from planets outside the solar system. But on the following page, I discover this sentence: thus, although visits from outer space are believed to be possible, they are thought to be highly improbable. What was the answer? Was this just a wandering discussion of possibilities, badly put together, or was it a hint of the truth? It could be the first step in preparing America for a revelation. It could also be a carefully thought-out trick. This whole report might be designed to conceal a secret weapon.